Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox talks to an expert in lending about how rising interest rates are making Ohio students rethink student debt. Also, Jay will have a conversation with a man who came within 90 minutes of execution while he was on death row for a murder he did not commit. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, here's Jay Fox.
U.S. News and World Report ranked the Ohio State University as the top-ranked engineering school in the country. Now, folks, that degree comes with a price, just like many other degrees, especially as federal student loan interest rates have surged to their highest levels in over a decade. Brian Walsh is a certified student loan expert. He also has the best title, Head of Advice and Planning. I love that. Head of Advice and Planning at SoFi. And I got to ask you, if you're a student facing the economics of higher education in 2024, especially at a nationally ranked school like Ohio State, what are you thinking right now?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me. And I really, number one, it is intimidating and it's stressful for students and families. But the good news is I think families can do two things to help really ease this burden. Number one is being very strategic on the school they select and how much debt they're willing to take on based on what their interests are, what their intended major is going to be. And number two, once they select that school, it really is about minimizing the amount you borrow through taking advantage of your financial aid package, choosing the right student loans, and really going through that experience. And I think to really exemplify that, you hit on, you know, the Ohio State University and, you know, the engineering program. Someone who's going to be an engineering major has much more flexibility to take on student loan debt and take on more costs than, let's say, I'll use education major as an example, because that's what my wife was. So it's figuring out those career earnings, estimated graduation time, things like that, to really determine what route you should go.
If I'm planning today and I'm thinking about my salary adjusted for inflation 4 to 8 years from now, depending upon what my major is, then I can figure out, okay, I'm going to take a percentage of what I make and apply it to student debt. Typically, what would that percentage be?
Yeah, so realistically, if you're looking at your annual income to how much debt you're going to borrow, you want to try to keep it below what your average income would be. And that sounds like a scary number, but that's something that is going to be, you know, somewhat manageable moving forward. Obviously, the lower you have it, the better off you're going to be. What we don't want to see is, let's say, someone who has average earnings of $35,000, $40,000 a year taking on six figures of student loan debt, because that's going to be very challenging to pay back unless they work for, let's say, a nonprofit or a government organization where they have access to public service loan forgiveness, which can be an extremely valuable benefit.
When you mentioned public student loan forgiveness, there are also indications that the federal government is going to continue some form of student debt forgiveness. Do you see that continuing, or is that something that will be based on the outcome of the November election?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of things are going to be based on the outcome of the November election. What I will say, as a financial planner over the last few years, it's been an extremely challenging time for people. Student loans have gotten more attention in the last like 3-4 years, the entire first 15 years of my career. And there's a lot of news about it. At the end of the day, the broad student loan forgiveness that was proposed by the Biden administration got struck down by the Supreme Court. So it didn't go through. But what you've seen over the last few years is you've seen an improvement to an income-driven repayment option called the SAVE plan. So it connects your payments to a percentage of your income. You spread it out over a longer period of time, makes it more affordable. The other thing that you've seen that, you know, we expect to continue would be existing programs, but they're getting much more attention. So it looks great in the news when you say, okay, we forgave, you know, this amount of money, this amount of money, this amount of money. A lot of these were connected to programs that existed already, really, to public service loan forgiveness, related to making income-driven repayments for a certain period of time, and then some extra ones related to maybe, you know, schools that didn't do the right things and students borrowed from those schools. So it's confused a lot of people because a lot of people think it's way more broad and way more applicable from a forgiveness perspective than what it actually is.
So regardless, the schools still get paid.
The schools are getting paid. So if a federal student loan gets forgiven, that ultimately comes from the taxpayers. That money already went to the schools, and it's just a question of who repays that money.
We've talked about what it's like to plan as a student, but what if you're the parent of a student? I put two kids through college. I understand what that's like, but that was 10 years ago. Where are we today with parenting?
Yeah, parents are in a tough spot right now, to be honest with you, because I have two young kids, so I'm more on the saving phase. But I still understand the fact that when you're a parent, you want to provide every opportunity possible for your child. At the same time, parents need to be careful right now, because a lot of parents aren't in a good position when it comes to their own retirement. There's no student loan equivalent when it comes to your own retirement. So the options there, if you dip into savings, maybe you're paying out of pocket and you're decreasing what your savings, or you take on loans in your own name that you have to pay for the next 5, 10, 20 years, that can put you even further behind. So we work one-on-one with parents to say, okay, is your retirement on track without any contributions towards your child's education? And if not, then it's not even an option. The student has to take on that debt. If they are on track, then you kind of stress test the plan to say, okay, like how much wiggle room do we have, and really use that to guide it, because we don't want parents overcommitting and putting themselves in a tough spot.
To what degree does declining enrollment at colleges and universities impact this discussion? For example, in Ohio, Notre Dame College in Cleveland closed its doors after over 100 years because of declining enrollment. How does that play into this conversation?
I think where it comes into play is people are considering more options than they did in the past. So when something costs more money, and then you hit on in the intro on the interest rate on federal student loans, it's at the highest rate in almost 20 years now. People pay attention more to costs when you put bigger numbers on it. So what we're seeing families do is, instead of going to where their friends are going, or boyfriend or girlfriend, or where parents went, or whatever it may be, thinking more strategically about where they go off to school. So maybe if someone's undecided, they go to a two-year school and then transition to a four-year school once they know what they want to do. Or maybe they go to a satellite campus and then they transition to the main campus. Even seeing that happening with people who are going into lower earning majors, those types of things I think weren't happening as much before. And it's great for the students. It's great for the parents, for them to make those types of decisions.
What about the impact of students choosing to live at home and go to either a community college or a regional campus rather than paying for a dorm or a fraternity or a sorority?
Yeah, that's a great point. That is something that we are seeing more of, similar to maybe you started a less expensive school and transferred to a more expensive school. On a similar note, we're seeing more of that, where maybe they stay close to home, especially if they're an undecided major or they are going to be going towards maybe a lower earning major. And I think we've seen that more normalized throughout the course of the pandemic, where, quite frankly, you saw kids going off to school and then they're brought home for 6 months or a year, or sometimes even longer. So that kind of normalized that. And it made it something that we saw more common from that point moving forward. And now it's really to control costs, because it's going to save money on how much you borrow. Typically, if you live at home, depending on where you live, most of the time you're going to a less expensive school. Maybe you're going to a two-year school or a satellite campus or things like that. So it can be a good solution for people who are undecided or pursuing lower earning majors. So shop around, check your rates online, make sure you're getting the best deal possible.
We want to thank Brian Walsh for being with us from SoFi today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
We're talking today with attorney Jacqueline Green, a civil rights attorney who is representing exonerated death row inmate Derek Jamison, who also joins us. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This case began with a crime back in 1984 when a bar owner was beaten to death during a robbery. 2 months later, Mr. Jameson was arrested for robbing a Cincinnati restaurant, which was unrelated to the bar crime. But then he was tied to the bar murder. How did police make that correlation?
Well, that's a question you're really going to have to talk to the police about, because what we know now and what Mr. Jameson was able to discover later on after he had been on death row for years and years was that the police had information that initial descriptions of the suspects, the people involved, descriptions from the people who were present did not actually match Mr. Jameson. Ultimately, a person named him, but that was after that person had contact with police and the police had this other information.
So, Mr. Jameson, when you were indicted for murder in 1985, you knew you were not guilty. How did the indictment make you feel?
It was an awful feeling because, as you know, on my indictment, when they asked for the evidence on my evidence on the evidentiary part, it had N-O-N-E, none, no evidence. So they didn't give them, we didn't know nothing about the case at the time when I was arrested and charged with this crime, you know. I didn't know nothing about this case, and I had never been in Central Cafe before, so I knew I didn't have nothing to do with this, you know.
What's the feeling of frustration like as you heard the charges being read against you?
Yeah, it was awful feeling, man. And then it was a capital case too. And they talking about killing me. They talking about executing me. Even before I'm found guilty, they talking about executing me.
You filed for an appeal twice, once in 1988 and once in 1992. And those didn't go so well.
Like you said, it didn't go well. It was awful feeling, you know. They turned one of your appeals down. It's awful feeling, you know.
It's even more extraordinarily dehumanizing to be on death row, sentenced to death for a crime you did not commit. And when in that circumstance, people still have this hope that, well, I didn't do it and I have this right to an appeal and I'm going to pursue that and that's going to clear my name. And then that doesn't happen again. And there's this interest in finality sometimes and whether certain procedures were followed or not, rather than, you know, getting to the real truth of the matter. And that often is what happens. People are denied the opportunity to obtain evidence. They're denied the opportunity to pursue different court proceedings to present information that maybe they have learned, of course, don't deem it to be new enough, important enough, whatever it may be, right? And so that hope that they have that the appeal is going to clear their name, of course, then if the appeal doesn't work out, it's denied. It's just devastating. You know? You've already been convicted for something you didn't do, and then you thought the process was going to work. It doesn't. You appeal. You think the process is going to work this time. It doesn't. It's devastating, and it demonstrates some of the really deep flaws in our criminal legal system when this happens. And it wasn't until many years later that Mr. Jameson, through this habeas litigation, was able to actually finally obtain the evidence, the documents, the information that proved what he knew all along. He was innocent. And the information had been withheld. It had been suppressed. It had been denied him as a tool for him and his lawyers to use during his criminal trial. And that is an absolute travesty of injustice in our court system to have to contend with.
Let's identify what is a writ of habeas corpus and how did that play into his exoneration?
So do you want to talk about it?
Well, I got one of the worst cases in American history. The homicide detectives and the prosecutor withheld 35 pieces of evidence. You only need one piece of new evidence. They withheld 35 pieces of evidence in my case, you know? And while I was on death row, I had 6 day of execution. That's more than anybody I ever heard of having. I had 6 day of execution. They came to kill me 6 times. They asked me 6 times, what did I want my body sent? You know, what did I want for my last meal? Check my veins to see was I ready to die.
One of which was 90 minutes.
We was on lockdown, so they couldn't get our legal mail to us. So I didn't know I had to stay, you know. I found out, you know, at the last moment that I had to stay. Ain't that something? You know, I'm thinking they're going to come and kill me, you know.
And I have to ask the question, at any point in time, Did you feel like giving up?
No. My faith wouldn't let me give up. My mom told me, she said, baby, anytime things get hard, pray. I did a lot of praying, you know, a lot of people didn't know this, but when I went to Catholic school when I was a kid, you know, so, you know, I ain't never lost my faith, you know, I always had faith.
Attorney Green, the writ of habeas corpus, how long has that been in play? And for those that are not in the legal profession, can you put it in layman's terms for the audience?
And most people who pursue habeas claims don't prevail. There's not an especially generous eye in the court system to evaluating the claims of people. And like I said, there are a lot of ways to what we said, what I called earlier, is kind of do it a little wrong, procedurally default, or other types of problems where, if again, it's not done just exactly right, there's some little thing that wasn't quite done, then the whole thing can be shut down. And once that's over, I mean, there's really no other opportunity short of receiving some powerful new evidence to come back and say, hey, you know, I need a new trial. And a lot of times it's really, really hard to do that because there has been new evidence discovered along the way, maybe around or shortly after the time of the direct appeal, maybe as a person's in prison. You know, you try to go to court and say, well, I have this new thing. And the court says, well, that's not enough, you know. But once you use it once, you can't use it again. And if you go down the years and you have now five things you've discovered over the years, individually, maybe they weren't enough. Together to the court, they would make a whole lot of sense. You know, a lot of times there's still not a very generous view in the courts to review that evidence and to grant somebody a new trial when what they experienced the first time around was a fundamentally unfair trial.
Your height made a critical difference as they looked at the two suspects and the testimony from the one convicted felon said it wasn't someone who was 6'4", and you're 6'4". Shouldn't that have been obvious?
It should have been, you know, because the two suspects, one of them, they say, were 5'1 and 5'3". And as you can see, I ain't never been 5'9" in my life. I'm a giant. You know, I'm 6'4" and a half.
Derek Jamison was wrongfully imprisoned for this crime, and we want a declaration saying so. And so that's where we're at right now.
So when does all of this take place?
Well, the case has just been filed, and the length of the case will be determined by whether it becomes an adversarial process with the state of Ohio, and we're engaged in, you know, the kind of classic court battle, or whether there ultimately at some point is some resolution reached and we come to an agreement about how to proceed.
All right. So I want to thank Attorney Jacqueline Green and Derek Jamison for being our guests today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
The mass shooting in the Short North injured 10 people. The violence sparked safety concerns for Columbus's popular nightlife district, and it's all met with growing calls on elected officials to ask. Thanks for joining us for Face the State. I'm Doug Petcash. From the mayor to the governor, we've been getting answers about what should be done to address an issue becoming all too familiar to our community. In Columbus alone, the Gun Violence Archive says we've had 12 mass shootings since the start of 2023. When we compare that to other cities similar in size during the same time period, we see Charlotte, North Carolina has had 4 mass shootings and San Jose, California has had 0. This all raises the question, what can Columbus do differently? The city launched new safety measures, including more patrol officers and enforcing a curfew on kids between 13 and 17 years old. But still, Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther says the best solution is stricter gun laws, something the city has tried to enforce for years, but that legislation has been tied up in lawsuits as state law restricts local authorities from making their own gun laws. In a statement after the mass shooting, the mayor told state and federal governments to step up or, quote, get out of our way and let us act. A frustration he repeated just days later, to 10TV's Kevin Landers.
So we've had 3 mass shootings in 3 weeks in the state of Ohio. What happened last night at the state legislature? A ban on transgender kids using the bathroom. not a damn thing about gun safety, not a damn thing to stop the proliferation of guns. That's unacceptable.
What do you do as a mayor? I mean,
encourage people to come out and vote. Look, we got a presidential election. We got half the U.S. Senate. We got all the members of the House of Representatives on the ballot this fall. If you're as pissed off as I am about gun safety, go and vote that issue. Demand answers from people running for office. What are they going to do to get guns off the street? What are they going to do to stop the proliferation of guns in our cities?
We asked Governor Mike DeWine about the city leaders asking the state to step up. He says he wants state lawmakers to specifically focus on the repeat violent offenders who are getting guns.
Well, I think something that we ought to be able to do, and I've continued to ask the state legislature to do this, is to focus on repeat violent offenders who are told time and time again, you're not allowed to have a gun anymore, and yet they persist in having a gun. And those individuals that we find in that situation who have a gun, who are not supposed to have a gun, we ought to be able, the local judge ought to be able to throw the book at them, get them out of that community. We have to remove some of these individuals from these communities, whether it is Columbus, whether it is Dayton, whether it is Cleveland.
Governor DeWine also called for investments in youth programs. He says the people involved in these shootings are often young, saying we should grow programs like the Boys and Girls Clubs across Ohio. Meanwhile, at the State House, this General Assembly has not passed any new gun laws since it started in January of 2023. However, lawmakers have proposed several. One would prohibit anyone with a domestic violence conviction from owning a gun. Another would mandate having a concealed carry permit to have a gun in public. There's also a bill to require a background check when buying a gun. And another would ban any semi-automatic designed or specially adapted to fire more than 31 rounds without reloading. However, all of these bills are stuck in House committee. Republican House Speaker Jason Stevens says right now there's no appetite in the Republican caucus to pass new gun laws.
In different parts of Ohio, it's a very different environment, if you will. You know, you get to rural Ohio where you will have one sheriff's deputy on duty that covers an entire county. And a lot of folks in those types of counties and those types of areas, you know, they're going to defend themselves.
House Minority Leader Allison Russo brings up the same concerns Columbus City leaders are voicing.
This General Assembly, again, has stood in the way of our local law enforcement and our local officials to be able to adequately respond to what is happening in their communities. And at the end of the day, lives are at risk and public safety is at risk.
Now, here's a look at the data. Since the 135th General Assembly started back in January of 2023, the Gun Violence Archive says there have been 42 mass shootings across Ohio. A mass shooting is defined as one with four or more victims. In those 42 incidents, 41 people died and 184 people were injured. In total, Ohio has the sixth most mass shootings in the country. Texas is number one, followed by California, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Florida. We're going to continue to monitor the State House. If any proposed gun laws go up for a vote, we will keep you updated. Lawmakers were slated to vote on 56 bills before leaving for a long break that's expected to last until November. However, one bill they did not vote on is a controversial bill that would make major changes at Ohio's universities and colleges. It's called the Ohio Higher Education Enhancement Act, or Senate Bill 83. The bill's sponsor, State Senator Jerry Serino, says a third party had reached out to him saying Speaker Jason Stevens wanted to work with him on the bill over the summer. But Serino says he's not interested because he had heard nothing from Stevens since they last talked in December.
There's nothing for me to really talk about over the summer. You know, I don't know what issues he might have, but it's just, I would be negotiating with myself because we have already made a number of concessions in the last 12 months to the House.
Serino says he'll wait for a more favorable environment in the House before bringing the bill back for discussion. That could be in the late fall or not until the next General Assembly at the beginning of 2025. The bill was introduced in March of 2023. It would prohibit any mandatory orientation or training courses regarding diversity, equity, and inclusion unless federal law requires it. It would also prohibit universities from endorsing or opposing controversial beliefs or policies unless it directly impacts funding or its mission of discovery. It also limits collective bargaining for faculty on issues such as workload or evaluations and tenure. Speaker Stevens has said consistently in the past that there aren't enough votes in the House for Senate Bill 83 to pass, so he hasn't brought it to a floor vote. One bill lawmakers passed in both chambers came with a $4.2 billion price tag. That's the state's capital budget. Most of the money will go to build, renovate, and maintain state buildings and places, including state parks and universities. But there's something different this year. The budget also includes $700 million in one-time money because of a budget surplus in 2023. That's extra tax revenue. The funding will go to community projects in all 88 counties. That's things like museum and arts projects, sports facilities, pickleball courts, and walking paths.
We set aside a pot that would say we're going to return money to the taxpayers through unique community projects, that those projects would either have an economic impact or maybe just improve the quality of life for everyday Ohioans.
Now, that bill also includes $600 million for the School Building Program Assistance Fund and $397 million for higher education projects around the state. We're also following a major step forward for Braden's Law. The legislation is now heading to the Senate after the Ohio House passed it before leaving for break. This is a bill 10TV has followed closely. 15-year-old Braden Marcus was an Olentangy High School football player who took his own life in 2021 when he became the victim of a financial sextortion scam. This proposed legislation honoring him would increase penalties for these crimes, making it a felony with extended prison time. A bill that allows human trafficking survivors to expunge certain nonviolent criminal records is now heading to the governor's desk to possibly become law. The House passed Senate Bill 214 with bipartisan support. Just one lawmaker voted no. The bill expunges records such as drug possession and shoplifting if the trafficking survivor committed the crimes while being victimized. Those in favor of it say a criminal record can be a roadblock for a job, for housing, and for educational opportunities.
Without our help, friends, victims have limited options for new life outside of a lifestyle that robs them of their human dignity.
The law will become the bill will become law 90 days after the governor signs it. Now to a controversial bill the Ohio House passed. The bill would ban transgender students from using bathrooms and locker rooms that match up with their gender identity. House Bill 183 was added to Senate Bill 104, which then passed as amended. The bill affects K-12 schools and college students. The American Medical Association says it opposes policies like this. Meanwhile, the bill now heads back to the Senate for when lawmakers return from break. Major news at the U.S. Supreme Court could have a ripple effect here in Ohio. The nation's highest court says it will take up a case involving gender-affirming care for transgender youth. It will review the constitutionality of a Tennessee law banning gender-affirming care for transgender minors, such as puberty blockers and hormone therapy.
These are teens who identify as transgender who are saying, but if I didn't identify as transgender, then some of these treatments would be available to me. So this is a violation of the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. You're treating similarly situated people differently, and you don't have a good enough reason to do so.
Arguments are set to take place in the fall. Meanwhile, here in Ohio, a hearing on the future of House Bill 68 is set for next month. The law bans gender-affirming medical care for transgender youth and prohibits transgender athletes from playing women's and girls' school sports. Last month, the judge rejected a state request to narrow the temporary restraining order, or TRO. The law was supposed to go into effect on April 24th until a lawsuit was filed against it.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
The State House is now quiet, and it's going to stay that way until November, as the 135th General Assembly takes a long break. Our reporter Roundtable is taking a look at what they've done over the past several months and looking ahead to what's next. Joining me today is Cleveland.com and Cleveland Plain Dealer politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, and reporter and producer with Ohio Public Radio and Television State House Bureau, Joe Ingles. Joe, Jeremy, thank you both for being here again today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, we're going to talk about what the legislature did, but let's start off with what they didn't do this time around. We spent a lot of time at the top of the show talking about gun violence here in the city of Columbus and across the state and what's been done and what hasn't been done. The state legislature hasn't passed a gun safety or gun control law in years. What is holding this up, Jeremy?
If anything, the state legislature's taken a lot of action to relax existing gun control laws. For example, now you don't need a permit to carry a concealed weapon. And this, of course, has come after several mass shootings, not just the one in Columbus, but if you look at Dayton in 2019 and a number of others. The governor a few years ago proposed, he doesn't want to call it a gun control bill, but it was essentially a gun control bill. It's gone absolutely nowhere in the legislature. I don't expect that will change anytime soon. There's just not a belief that these mass shootings will be curbed by restricting guns in the way that Democrats want them to be.
And Joe Jason Stevens, the Speaker of the House, has said there's no appetite in the House.
Right. And I've heard a lot of voters say that they would like to see the current gun laws on the books enforced, because a lot of times you see some of these crimes and they involve people who should have had guns taken away by current laws, but they weren't removed. So there is an appetite for that in this General Assembly. But the question is, how do you do that? It's real easy to say some things, but it's not as easy to do them.
Another big issue that didn't have any action taken on it this time was marijuana in terms of legislation. Now, rules are being rolled out and licenses are now being approved to sell for recreational adult use marijuana. We heard a lot about negotiations between the House and the Senate and different parties involved in this whole thing, but nothing has come about. Joe, do you know what's holding it up at this point?
Well, you know, there's a lot of disagreement over marijuana. And again, like guns, marijuana is, it depends on where you are a lot of times as to how you perceive it. A lot of even the rural areas where you have lawmakers from those counties where they don't have a lot of you know, where you would think maybe that's not a popular option, they're very, very reluctant to go in and try to change something that their voters have approved. And that's the, you know, there was language, a general skeleton outline in the language that was on the ballot last year. And so now we've got the cannabis control agency of the state who's going through and actually making the detailed rules. And some of the things that voters are talking about that they would like to see controlled, for example, marketing to kids or having pot around kids, you know, smoking outdoors.
Public.
Yes, those kind of things. The Cannabis Control Commission is actually coming in and they're writing rules that take those into effect. So there seems to be, among some lawmakers, a question of really do we need to do anything right now?
But isn't there still a question, though, about like the revenue from taxes and how that would, where it would go?
Right? Correct. And for those more controversial issues, the main holdup has been House Speaker Jason Stevens. Right after the November election last year, Matt Huffman, the Senate president, came out saying, hey, we need to change the tax rate. We need to make a number of other changes. The governor came out, said, well, we need to take action and pass a bill right away to change this law. And it's been Jason Stevens who's been slow walking this and really effectively, as you said, leaving it up to changes to be made through rules. And so, as Joe said, there's a number of things that people can agree on, like don't market to children, don't smoke outside, don't have billboards, Delta 8, restricting Delta 8 products. But then these things about where does the money go, what should the tax rate be, things like that, we're not going to see probably anything on that until next session next year.
The next General Assembly
probably
after the
not.
Year. Another controversial issue that didn't have action this time was House Bill 83, or Senate Bill 83, didn't come up for a vote in the House. That is the one that deals with diversity, equity, and inclusion at the colleges and universities in Ohio, as well as some collective bargaining issues with the faculty. State Senator Jerry Serino, the sponsor of the bill, basically said he doesn't want to negotiate with the speaker anymore over the summer on this one. So this bill is kind of in limbo, right?
It's another bill where House Speaker Jason Stevens has been the main block between this bill and getting passed. They've been negotiating for months. As you mentioned, Jerry Serino is pretty frustrated about this. It looks like it's not going to pass. However, lawmakers did on Wednesday pass House Bill 214, which Senator Kathy Ingram said was basically the K-12 equivalent of Senate Bill 83. It prohibits schools from requiring employees or students from subscribing to any particular ideology, and it also allows students to take up to 3 religious expression days off from school per year.
And so we'll see how that progresses as well. And Joe, with House Bill or Senate Bill 83 also, that the Speaker has consistently said there just aren't enough votes in the House.
Yeah, he said there's not enough votes. If you listen to Serino, he says he's got it on good authority that there are enough votes. But here's the thing that Serino is saying now. There have been some concessions made, especially when it comes to union provisions in Senate Bill 83. And those are in the current form, right? He's saying if this doesn't go in the lame duck between the election and the end of the year and it has to go to the next General Assembly, he's threatening, you know, those might be included next time around, and you might have a General Assembly that would be more likely to pass it.
Well, let's talk about a couple things that did get done right now. The $4.2 billion state capital budget kind of went through with broad support. I think it was 30-1 vote and a 90-5 vote. This included $700 million in one-time spending that's going to be spread out all across the state. A very popular bill.
Yep.
Among the lawmakers.
Yeah, everyone got something out of it. You know?
Battle of the cookie jar.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And, you know, with that one-time money, that $700 million of one-time money, that allowed the lawmakers to go in and do some things that are popular in the communities. In fact, that's how they got this list of what they funded. A lot of that came from communities saying, we need pickleball courts or we need whatever it is. That's something they really wanted. They got it out of this. And now the lawmakers are going home for the summer. They're going to be campaigning because they want to win.
Yeah.
And guess what's going to happen? They're going to be able to say, you know those pickleball courts you got? I brought them to you.
You can put their name on them.
Exactly. Well, some of the things Columbus is getting particularly is $10 million for a new Columbus Symphony building. Mm-hmm. Hopewell, the newly designated UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Hopewell Mounds around Newark and also around southern Ohio, they're getting $13 million out of this. There are tens of millions of dollars to renovate the Rife and Road Center downtown. So Columbus is getting a big share of this money.
Let's look forward right now, too. Long break, and then they call it the lame duck session coming back in November. What do you expect to happen?
Chaos. I expect chaos, and then there's a couple of factors that determine how much chaos there will be. One is everyone's going to be looking at the House Republicans' election for Speaker next year. Jason Stevens is trying to hold on against Senate President Matt Huffman, who is term limited, and so he's trying to take over as Speaker. That's yet to be determined who has the votes for that. But if Matt Huffman wins that and Jason Stevens becomes basically a lame duck Speaker, then you're going to have a situation where you're going to see Stevens trying to get everything he can through or block everything before Huffman becomes Speaker next year.
What do you expect, Joe?
Yeah, I agree. Chaos is going to rule the day. I think that we're going to see a lot of things that there are a lot of controversial bills that have either passed one chamber or the other. We're going to see a real push to get those through. We're going to see, however it goes in November, if Ohio elects, Republicans like they have in recent elections, I think we could definitely see, more of this conservative legislation that's out there be sheltered through. So
I know all of our focus is now going to turn to the election as well. But Joe, Jeremy, thank you again for your time today. Really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
For most kids, summer is one of the best times of the year. But for parents, it can sometimes be the opposite, especially for those struggling to put food on the table. That's where the Mid-Ohio Food Collective comes in. They provide lunches for one of the largest summer camp programs in Central Ohio, the ETSS. And it's not your average camp. 10TV's Yolanda Harris explains why.
A healthy meal in the summer seems like a simple request, but for some, it's hard to find.
This program means the world to the families that we serve here. And here at the Sullivan location, many of the families are dependent on this service to make sure that a child is getting a hot meal for that day.
Sarah Huffman is the assistant director of youth programs. She says they want to make sure every kid has a hot meal and is still learning.
Our primary goal is to make sure that students are learning throughout the summer. Our goal is to prevent learning loss, particularly in areas where we are seeing that they are under-resourced and underserved.
Right now, ETSS and the Mid-Ohio Food Collective are projected to serve more than 600 students in 14 locations.
The overarching philosophy at the Food Collective is that food is health, whether it's providing nourishment through these hot meals, which are a lot more attractive to eat than a bag of crackers, right? Or whether it's providing the mental health and the security of knowing where your next meal is coming from. We want to be there for all of it.
The best part of all, it's entirely free.
Our program is completely free to all of the children that we serve. We ensure that every child who comes here walks away completely fed and that they have learned something that day.
That was Yolanda Harris reporting. The Mid-Ohio Food Collective says they provide a staggering 10,000 meals per week for students in the program.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.